We'd been airborne for about 10 minutes before the pilot came back along the aisle. He stopped beside us and looked at Sal with open admiration. "Jesus, lady," he shook his head. "I wouldn't have given a month's salary not to miss that. You were great." Sally, who'd have been suitably subdued since my warning, immediately perked up. "With boys that size, I don't even spit out the bones," she declared. And a couple of BYM, who heard it, swiveled in their seats with startled expressions. The pilot laughed delightedly and turned to me. "The man wants to speak to you, Doctor. I'll change places with you." Lurin was chit-chatting with flight control over the radio. But he waved me into the co-pilot seat and I squeezed behind the wheel and waited. Lurin ended his transmission and turned to me. "Breakfast? I've eaten." He ignored it and passed me a leg of cold turkey and a huge slice of chicken and egg pie from the hamper beside him. "Coffee in the thermos. Help yourself." "Did you get your £25 million loan?" I asked with a full mouth. "Yes, despite a last-minute panic." "I didn't think you needed to borrow, Lo. Have you fallen on hard times?" "Oil prospecting," he laughed at my suggestion. "Risk money. I prefer to gamble with other people's money and play the certainties with my own." He changed the subject smoothly. "Sorry about the detour. I'm dropping the boys off at Gaborone's. They've got a series of meetings with the Botswana government. Routine stuff, just settling the details of the concession. Anyway, it's not too far off our course, and then we can press on alone." He filled his mouth with turkey and spoke around it. "Met report is lousy, Ben. Thick cloud down on the deck over the whole northern area. Happens about once in 3 years that you get low overcast in the desert, but today's the day. Anyway, we'll have a stab at picking up the hills and the ruins. No harm done if we can't, though. We'll not learn anything more from the air." He was relaxed and easy, not a trace of his early rage. He could switch it on or off as he wished, and we talked and laughed together. I knew his mood. It was holiday and release. He was truly looking forward to it. Lost city or no lost city, it was an excuse to get out into the wild country that he loved. "Like old days. God, Ben, how long is it since we got away together? Must be all of 10 years. Remember the canoe trip down the Orange River? When was that? 56? Or 7? And the expedition to find the wild bushman? We must do it more often, Lo." "Yes," he said, and really meaning it, as though he had a choice. "We must. But there's so little time. It's running out so quickly. I'll be 40 years old next year." And his voice was wistful. "God, if only we could buy time with money." "We've got 5 days, I said, heading the conversation away from the quicksands, and he picked it up eagerly. It was another half an hour before he mentioned Sally. "That assistant of yours, the prize fighter. What's her name?" And I told him. "Are you having it away with her?" he asked. It was said so naturally and so casually that for an instant I didn't realize what had been said. Then I felt my vision blur with red rage, felt the blood pound in my temples and heat my throat and face. I think I could have killed him then. But instead I lied in a thick, shaken voice. "No," I said. "Just as well," he grunted. "She's a wild one. Oh, well, as long as she doesn't mess up the trip." If only I had told him then. But it was too private a thing, too precious and fragile to despoil with words, especially the words he had chosen. And then the moment was past, and I was sitting, trembling and shaky, as he talked on lightly about the 5 days ahead. As we flew, the cloud solidified beneath us, congealing into a dirty greyish blanket, that stretched away in all directions to the horizon. We crossed the border between South Africa and the independent African state of Botswana. At Gaborone's, the ceiling was down to 1,000 feet when we landed. Despite Lorin's assurance that we would be speedily airborne once more, there was a deputation of senior government officials and an invitation to drinks and food in the private dining room of the airport. Hot, sticky weather with intent white faces talking softly and greedily to shiny, intent black faces, all of them sweating in the heat and whiskey fumes and the thick swirls of cigar and cigarette smoke. 3 hours more before the Learjet, with just 4 of us aboard, slashed up into the cloud cover and then burst through into the high, bright sunshine. "Wow," said Lorin. "An expensive little party. That black bastard in Galeni has just read the price of his honour by another 20,000. I'll have to square him, of course. He could squash the whole deal. It has to go through his ministry." Lorin flew northwards with the map on his lap and a stopwatch in his hand. His eyes darted from compass to airspeed indicator and back to the watch. "Okay, Ben. You better let Roger take over the controls. We'll go down into the porridge and take a look-see." With Lorin and the pilot, Roger Van Deventer, at the controls, and Sal and I braced in the doorway of the cockpit behind them, the jet slanted down towards the floor of dirty cloud. A few wisps of the stuff flickered past, and then suddenly the sun was gone, and we were enfolded in the dark grey mist. Roger was flying, his attention completely on the instrument panel, and as the needle of the altimeter slowly unwound, I saw his hands tightening on the wheel. We dropped steadily lower through the grey filth. Now Roger pulled on the flaps and air brakes and throttled back. The three of us staring forward and down for the first glimpse of the earth. Down we sank. And still down. The pilot's tension turned to active fear. I could smell it. The rank, greasy tang of it. It was infectious. If he, the hardened flybird, was afraid, then I was prepared to be terrified. I knew suddenly that rather than risk Lorin's wrath, he would fly us straight into the ground. I decided to intervene and opened my mouth. It was unnecessary. "Overflown," grunted Lorin, checking the stopwatch. "Ease up, Rog." "Sorry, Mr. Stervisons. There's no bottom to this stuff." Roger said it like a sigh and lifted the Lear's nose. He opened the throttle and let off the air brakes. "No go," I murmured with relief. "Ah, well, forget it, Lo. Let's go on to Maun." Lorin turned to look back at me and instead looked into Sally's face. She stood behind his shoulder. I couldn't see her expression, but I could guess what it was by the tone in which she said softly, "Chicken?" Lorin stared at her a moment longer, and then he grinned. I could have turned Sally over my knee and beaten that luscious backside to a pulp. The warm, active fear I had felt the minute before turned now to cold, numbing terror. For I'd seen Lorin grin like that before. "Okay, Roger," he said, slipping the map and stopwatch into the pocket beside his seat. "I've got her." And the Lear stood on one wing as he pulled her around in a maximum rate turn. It was so finely executed that Sally and I merely sagged a little at the knees as gravity caught us. He levelled out and flew for 3 minutes on even keel, retracing our course. I stole a glance at Sally's face. It was bright-eyed and flushed with excitement. She was staring ahead into the impenetrable murk. Again, Lorin banked the aircraft steeply and came out of the turn, flying the reciprocal of our previous course, and eased the nose downwards. This was no cautious groping with flaps and half-throttle. Lurin flew us in boldly and fast. Sally's hand groped for mine and squeezed. I was afraid and angry with both of them. I was too old for these children's games, but I returned her grip, as much for my own comfort as hers. "Christ, Lo," I blurted. "Take it easy, will you?" And no one took the least notice of me. Roger was frozen in his seat, hands gripping the armrests, staring ahead. Lurin was deceptively relaxed behind the controls as he hurtled us into mortal danger, and Sally Dammer was grinning all over her face and hanging on to my icy hand like a child on a roller coaster. Suddenly we were into rain, pearly strings and snakes of it writhing back over the rounded perspex windscreen. I tried to protest again, but my voice stuck somewhere in my parched throat. There was wind outside now. It buffeted the sleek, gleaming body of the Lear, and the wings rocked. I felt like crying. I didn't want to die now. Yesterday would have been fine, but not after last night. Before my own reflexes had even registered, Lurin had seen the ground and caught the headlong plunge of the jet. With a soft shudder that threw Sally and I gently together, he pulled us up level with the earth. This was even more terrifying than the blind fall through space. The dark, hazy outlines of the low, scrubby treetops flicked by our wingtips close enough to touch, while ahead of us, through the rain mist, an occasional big baobab tree loomed, and Lurin eased the jet over its greedily clinging branches. Seconds that seemed like a lifetime passed, and then abruptly the filthy curtains of rain and cloud were stripped aside, and we burst into a freak hole in the weather. There before us, full in our path, and washed by watery sunlight, stood a rampart of red stone cliffs. It was only the merest fleeting glimpse of red rock rushing down on us, and then Lurin had dragged the jet up on its tail, and the rock seemed almost to scrape our belly as we slid over the crest and arrowed upwards into the clouds, with the force of gravity squashing me down on buckling knees. No one spoke until we'd plunged out into the sunlight high above. Sally softly disengaged her hand from mine as Lurin turned in his seat to look at us. I noticed, with grim satisfaction, that both he and Sally were looking slightly greenish with reaction. They stared at each other for a moment, and then Lurin snorted with laughter. "Look at Ben's face," he roared. And Sally thought that was very funny. When they finished laughing, Sally asked eagerly, "Did anyone see the ruins? I just got a glimpse of the hills, but did anyone see the ruins?" "The only thing I saw," muttered Roger, "was my own hairy little ring." And I knew how he felt. The cloud was breaking up by the time we reached Maun. Roger took us in through a gap and put us down sedately, and Peter Larkin was waiting for us. Peter is one of the very few left. An anachronism, complete with fat cartridges looped to the breast of his bush jacket and his trousers tucked into the tops of mosquito boots. He has a big, red, beefy face and huge hands, the right index finger scarred by the recoil of heavy rifles. His single level of communication is a gravelly, whiskey-raddled shout. He has no feelings and very little intelligence, so consequently never experiences fear. He has lived in Africa all his life and never bothered to learn a native language. He uses the lingua franca of South Africa, the bastard Fanagalo, and emphasizes his points with boot or fist. His knowledge of the animals on which he preys is limited to how to find them and where to aim to bring them down. And yet there is something appealing about him in an elephantine, oafish way. While his gang of hunting boys loaded our gear into the trucks, he shouted amiable inanities at Lurin and me.
Wish I was coming with you. Got this bunch of Yanks arriving tomorrow, with a big sack of green dollars. Short notice you gave me, Mr. Stuyvesant. But I'm giving you my best, boys. Good rains in the south. Be plenty of game in the area. Should run into Gemsbok this time of the year. And Jumbo, of course. I shouldn't be surprised if you got a Simba or two.
The coy use of pet names for game animals sickens me, especially when the intention is to blast them with a high-velocity rifle. I went to where Sally was supervising the packing of our gear. "It's after 1 o'clock already," she protested. "When do we get cracking?"
"Oh, we'll probably push through to the top end of the Makarikari pan tonight. It's about 200 miles on a fair road. Tomorrow we'll bash off into the deep bush."
Is Ernest Hemingway coming with us?" she asked, eyeing Peter Larkin with distaste.
"No such luck," I assured her.
I was trying to form some idea of those who were accompanying us. Two drivers, their superior status evident in the white shirts, long grey slacks and shod feet, with paisley-patterned scarves knotted at the throat, one for each of the 3-ton trucks. Then there was the cook, carrying a lot of weight from his sampling, skin glossy from good food. Two gnarled and grey-headed gun boys, who had jealously taken out Lurin's sporting rifles from the other luggage, had unpacked them from their travelling cases, and were now fondling and caressing them lovingly. These were the elite, and took no part in the frenzied scurryings of the camp boys as they packed away our gear. Bangamwatos, most of them. I listened briefly to their chattering. The gun boys were Matabili, as was to be expected, and the drivers were Shangans. Good. I would understand every word spoken on this expedition. "By the way, Sal," I told her quietly, "don't let on that I speak the language." "Why?" She looked startled. "I like to monitor the goings-on, and if they know I understand, they'll freeze." She pulled a face. "Svengali?" I don't think I'd have laughed if anyone else had called me that. It was a bit too close to the bone. We went to shake hands and say goodbye to Roger, the pilot. "Don't frighten the lions," Roger told Sally. Clearly she had made another conquest. He climbed into the jet and we stood in a group and watched him taxi out to the end of the runway and then take off and wing away southwards.
"What are we waiting for?" asked Lurin. "What indeed," I agreed.
Lurin took the wheel of the Land Rover, and I climbed in beside him. Sally was in the back seat, with the gun-bearers on the bench seats.
"With you two, I feel a damn sight safer on the ground," I said.
The road ran through open scrubland and baobab country, dry and sun-scorched. The Land Rover lifted a pale bank of drifting dust, and the two trucks followed us at a distance to let it settle. There were occasional steep, rock-strewn, dry riverbeds to cross, and at intervals we passed villages of mud and thatched huts where the naked, pot-bellied piccaninnies lined the side of the road to wave and sing as though we were royalty. Sally soon ran out of pennies, throwing them to watch the resulting scramble and clapping her hands with delight. When she started tossing our lunch out of the window, I pulled my guitar from its case to distract her. "Sing happy, Ben," Sally instructed. "And bawdy," added Lauren. I think it was to needle her, or perhaps test her. "Yes, yes," Sally agreed readily. "Make it meaty and happy." And I started with the saga of the wild, wild duck, with Sal and Lauren shouting the chorus at the end of each verse. We were children, going on a picnic that first day out, and we made a good run of it to the pan. The sun was a big fat ball of fire amongst the tattered streamers of cloud on the horizon when we came out onto the edge of the pan. Lurin parked the Land Rover, and we climbed out to wait for the trucks, and stared out with silent awe across that somber, glistening salt plain that stretched away to the range of the eye. When the trucks arrived, they spilled their load of black servants before they'd properly stopped, and I timed it at 17.5 minutes to when the tents were pitched, the camp beds made up, and the three of us sitting around the fire drinking Glen Grant malt on the rocks of glistening ice that dewed the glasses. From the cooking fire drifted the tantalizing smell of the hunter's pot as our cook reheated it and tossed in a dash more garlic and oregano. They were a good cheerful gang that Larkin had given us, and after we'd eaten, they gathered around their own fire, 50 yards away, and sweetened the night with the old hunting songs. I sat and listened half to them, and half to the involved and heated argument between Sal and Lorraine. I could have warned her that he was playing the devil's advocate, needing her once again, but I enjoyed the interplay of two good minds. Whenever the discussion threatened to degenerate into personal abuse and actual physical violence, I intervened reluctantly and herded them back to safety. Sally was staunchly defending the premise of my book Ophir that postulated an invasion of southern Central Africa by Phoenician or Carthaginian colonizers in about 200 BC, and which flourished until about AD 450 before disappearing abruptly. They were not equipped for a major voyage of discovery as early as that, Lorin challenged, let alone a colonizing. You will find, Mr. Stuyvesant, that Herodotus records a circumnavigation of Africa in the reign of King Necho. It was led by 6 Phoenician navigators as early as 600 BC, or thereabouts. They started at the apex of the Red Sea and in 3 years returned through the Pillars of Hercules. A single voyage, Lorin pointed out. Not a single voyage, Mr. Stuyvesant. Hanno sailed from Gibraltar to a point south in the west coast of Africa in about 460 BC, a voyage from which he returned with bartered ivory and gold sufficient to whet the appetites of all the merchant adventurers. Still, Lorin attacked her dates. How do you get a date of 200 BC when the very earliest carbon datings from the foundations of Zimbabwe are mid-5th century AD? And most of them are later. We aren't concerned with Zimbabwe, but with the culture that preceded it, Sally came back at him. Zimbabwe could have been built towards the end of the ancients' reign, probably only occupied for a short time before they disappeared. That would fit neatly with your carbon dating of around AD 450. Besides, the carbon dating from the ancient mines at Shala and in Zwezwe show results at 250 and 300 BC. And then she ended it with fine feminine logic. Anyway, carbon dating isn't all that accurate. It could be out by hundreds of years. The mines were worked by the Bantu, declared Lorin. And Caton Thompson, and of course more recently Summers, said... Fiercely she attacked Lorin. Did the Bantu, who only probably arrived in the area about AD 300, suddenly conceive of a brilliant prospecting talent which enabled them to locate the metal lodes where not a scrap of it showed in the ore as visible gold or copper? Did they at the same time develop engineering know-how that enabled them to remove 250 million tons of ore from rock at depth? And remember, they'd never demonstrated these talents before. And did they abruptly forget or cease to use them for another 1,000 years? Well, the Arab traders, they may have... Lorin began, but Sally rode over him without a check. Why did they mine it at such risk and expenditure of energy? Gold has no value to the Bantu. Cattle are their standard of wealth. Where did they learn how to dress and use rock for building? The Bantu had never done it before, and suddenly the art was fully fledged and highly skilled, and then instead of becoming more refined, the art deteriorated rapidly and then died out. With assumed reluctance, Loren retreated steadily before her onslaughts. But he made his final stand when my own theory of incursion from the west instead of the east came under discussion. Loren had read the views and arguments of all my many detractors and critics, and he repeated them now. The accepted theory was that the point of entry was from the Sofala coast, or the mouth of the Zambezi. I had put forward the theory based on the evidence of early texts and extensive excavations of my own, that a Mediterranean people left that sea through the Pillars of Hercules and voyaged steadily down the western coast of Africa, probably establishing trading stations on the gold, the ivory, and the Nigerian coasts, until their southward explorations led them into an unpeopled vacuum. I guessed at a river mouth, long since dried and silted, or altered in its course and depth in the present day. A river that drained what then would have been the huge lakes of Makarikari, Ngami, and others long since disappeared, shriveled by the progressive desiccation of southern Africa. They entered the river, possibly the Kunini or the Orange, journeyed up it to its source, and from there sent their metallurgists overland to discover the ancient mines of Manica. And who knows but they discovered the diamonds and the gravel of the lakes and rivers. And certainly they would have hunted the vast herds of elephant that roamed the land. Sufficient wealth to justify the establishment of a city, a great walled fortress and trading station. Where would they site this city? Clearly at the limit of waterborne travel. On the shores of the furthest lake, Makarikari, perhaps, or the lake that overflowed the present boundaries of the Great Salt Pan. Sally and Loren argued with increasing acrimony and bitterness. Sally called him an impossible man, and he countered with Madam Know-It-All. And then, suddenly, Loren capitulated, and the next minute all three of us were joyously anticipating the discovery of the lost city of Makarikari. The lake would have spread at least 50 miles beyond the boundaries of the present Pan, Loren pointed out. Only 100 years ago, Burchill describes Lake Ngami as an inland sea, and nowadays it's a puddle you can jump across without straining yourself. It's altogether probable that the ancient lake extended to the foot of the hills on which our ruins are placed. We have plenty of evidence of the gradual desiccation and drying up of southern Africa. Read Cornwallis Harris's description of the forests and rivers which no longer exist. Ben, and Sally grabbed my arm with excitement. The crescent shape of the city. Do you remember me puzzling about it? It could be the shape of the ancient harbour, with the town following the shoreline. God, Loren whispered. I can hardly wait for tomorrow. It was after midnight, and the whiskey bottles had taken a terrible beating before Loren and Sally went off to their tents. I knew I couldn't sleep, so I left the camp, passing the fire around which lay the blanket-cocooned bodies of our servants, and I walked out into the surface of the pan. The stars lit the salt a ghastly grey, and it crunched crisply with each pace I took. I walked for a long time, stopping once to listen to the distant roaring of a lion from the edge of the bush. When I returned to the camp, a lantern still burned in Sally's tent, and her silhouette was magnified against the pale canvas, a huge, dark portrait of my love. She was reading, sitting cross-legged upon her camp bed. But as I watched, she reached across and extinguished the lantern. I waited a while, gathering my courage, and then I went to her tent, and my heart threatened to hammer its way out of its malformed ribcage. Sal! Ben, she answered my whisper softly. May I come in? She hesitated before she replied. All right, just for a minute. I went into the tent, and in the gloom her nitrous was a pale blur. I groped for her face and touched her cheek.
"I came to tell you that I love you," I said softly.
And I heard her little catch of breath in the dark. When she answered, her voice was gentle. "Ben," she whispered. "Dear, sweet Ben."
"I would like to be with you tonight."
And it seemed to me there was regret in her voice as she replied, "No, Ben. Everyone would know about it. And I don't want that."